Gary, are these so-called internet friends really friends?
Well, friends, that's an interesting word. Modern technology, a lot of words change. So let's look at what friends are. And now, in 1828, Webster's Dictionary, and this is the definition that I grew up with, by the way, a noun, friend, one who is attached to another by affection, one who entertains for another sentiments of esteem, respect, and affection, which lead him to desire his company and to seek to promote his happiness and prosperity, opposed to foe or enemy. That's the noun. And there's a proximity involved in that. You know the person. There was no internet at the time. But wait, let's look at another word called friendly. Now that's an adjective. Having the temper and disposition of a friend. Oh, well, of a friend. Kind, favorable, disposed to promote the good of another. Now, that's really what we're talking about on the internet is friendly. It also says not hostile as friendly, friendly power or estate. But now we're talking, even though we use it as a noun on the internet, friend, in fact, is friendly because there's not that, there's only the disposition to act like a friend. And so let's look at it. I've known you for, what, 3, 4 years now?
Something on that order. Yeah, it's been a while.
And with all the work we've done together, whether it be the these BEL recordings, preparation of articles, investigation, all these things, we've shared something far more intimate than a public discussion on Facebook. And I would consider that you are probably a friend. I've never met you. Quite frankly, I don't know your real name. Nor do you know
Oh,
mine.
well.
I think that we probably approach the noun friend very much because of the amount of things we've been involved in together and our willingness to trust and know that what we say between each other is confidential. Now, let's go to the friendly friends. You don't know. Oh, here's a good example. What was his name? Richard Kessler. We'll get into that a little more later, I think. But a lot of people were endeared to him. Oh, here's another one. I just saw something on the news the other night that this cop traveled 5 hours to have sex with what he thought was a 13-year-old girl. And not only was the local television station there, but waiting outside were the cops. So, what is a friend on the internet? You look at their picture. You don't see the mouth move or anything. You don't even know if that's what they look like. This 13-year-old girl, they showed her face in the news story, and she didn't look 13. She looked about 18 or 19, probably. So, and I don't know, they didn't explain if there were pictures involved with this or not, but it took just a couple hours for him to talk her into being receptive to him coming down to see her. So what is a friend on the internet? You see a face. You might even hear a voice on Skype or any of the VoIP, even on the telephone, but you know who's really on the other side. So we endear ourselves to these people in a temper and disposition, friendly, but we don't know enough to really extend that affection. Hey, you might be uglier than sin. I don't know. No. But now, let me back up a little bit. We have shared our videos on the internet, but still, that can hide many things. It is you. I know what you look like. You know what I look like. But there's no way to really sense things. God gave us senses, and those senses can tell us things, but they can't tell us things through the electronic age, not even the telephone. And it's until you sit down and have a beer together and spend time together, and we have spent that time, so we're mostly along that line. That's 3 or 4 years to get to a point where there's a feeling of implicit trust between us. So when we talk about friends on the internet, we're not really talking about friends. It's just Facebook and these other social media things have used the term inappropriately. They should be called contacts because we are in contact with each other.
Sure.
But they have verbicided the word friendly to mean contacts. And for the most part, people often foolishly accept that representation and assume these people are as much a friend as the guy they have a few beers with. And then, well, no telling what consequences come out of that.
Wouldn't the word acquaintance be accurate as well?
Am I acquainted with you? I don't know. We could look up acquaintance.
Well, it's just, well, it was something you kind of mentioned a moment ago, too, about, like, these fake accounts that are created. And just like any other, you know, piece of technology, you know, fake accounts on various websites can either be used for good or for ill. They can be used by trolls to go and harass people and, you know, dox them, you know, release their legal name, physical address, mailing address, phone numbers. Even I've even seen some social security numbers being leaked and so forth. But, you know, they can also be used by, you know, privacy advocates to try and move around and learn things and all that without being spied on by government or corporations and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of, you know, trying to associate with other internet users, it can be quite interesting, to say the least.
Okay, now acquaintance, well, before we go there, remember, you know what an avatar is.
Sure.
Look at some people put up an avatar that makes them look fierce or loving. They try and create a mood with the avatar.
A persona, yeah.
Create the persona. And so, and the same thing can be done with pictures. You know, if you're the picture on Skype or on Facebook is somebody that's appealing or fierce or, you know, well, the best one is camos and rifle slung over one shoulder, rifle on the other shoulder, two pistols on and a rifle in your hands and a mask on your face. Look at Charles Dyer. You know, how much did he do with that mask on, that white mask? So, you know, on the internet, you tend to want to project an image. And you want to project the image that you want to project. It might be a sincere, I want to look like I'm fierce, or I want to look like I'm loving, or it might be deceptive. So the ability to be deceptive on the internet is there. Now, an acquaintance, familiar knowledge, a state of being acquainted or of having intimate or more than slightly superficial knowledge, as I know the man, but I have no acquaintance with him. Sometimes it denotes a more slight knowledge. So that's somebody that you've met. And maybe you've got the beginnings of a friendship. But the element there is you've met that person in real life, not an avatar, not a picture, not a video on Skype, that you've actually met the person. And, you know, there's something real about sentences. I would never negotiate it when I had my business. I would never negotiate a contract on the phone. I wanted to be there. I wanted to see his body language. I wanted to see his inflections. I wanted to know where he was coming from. And you can't do that on the phone. You can't do it on Skype. You might get a little closer with Skype video, but you're not going to be in that real life situation where you know somebody and they were only acquaintances. They were not friends. Now, some of my clients did become friends over time, but so we've got acquaintances between the two, but it still requires that physical presence.
Sure. I mean, that kind of makes sense, too. I mean, having all of your senses engaged when you're talking with somebody in person is very, very different from, you know, even what you and I do, which is basically the equivalent of, like, talking on the phone.
Right.
Nothing wrong with that, but it's pretty restricted to, you know, audible and not much else.
Well, we'd probably talk on the phone more if you had a phone, but you don't have a phone, so we're stuck with Skype. So
you know what I mean. But
oh yeah, I know what you mean.
Well, something else I kind of wanted to ask you about too is, you know, what is the psychology do you think that is involved in associating with people on the internet?
Comfort. We all like to have friends, But I can have more friends on the internet than I can around where I live because there aren't that many people around where I live. Look at you. You live in an apartment in Texas, and how many friends do you have there?
One contact, pretty
Okay,
much
so how
at this
many friends
point.
do you have on the internet?
Well, I wouldn't call them friends, but I have more contact, sure.
Well, internet friends, let me put it that way. That's the adjective friends. Internet friends
Okay.
do you have?
Oh, easily more than 2 dozen.
Okay, so there's a gratification of having all these friends. Hey, when I die and my funeral, I want to have it virtual on the internet so all my friends can attend. Wait a minute. No, I don't.
Yeah, live stream it, right?
Right, virtual funeral. It's a gratification for people. Look at the people that have thousands of people. They probably haven't even talked to them all. I was very cautious initially about allowing friends. I looked at their background before I accepted them when they wanted to friend me on Facebook, for example. But I was getting old after a while. I found it's a lot easier to accept them as friends if they start selling things on the internet or talking about their dogs and cats all the time. I go in and unfriend them. So I decided it was a lot easier to add them as friends and then take them off. I have no idea how many friends I have on the internet now. Let me see, or on Facebook. If I can figure out which button to push.
Well, I mean that's kind of interesting too in terms of the verbiage because I know on Skype all the users are listed as contacts. That's the actual word that's used. But then on Facebook, the word that would have been used for contacts is instead called friends. So if you come across a user and you want to add them to what Skype would call a contacts list, instead the button says add friend.
Right, and I'm looking at my friends now. I have 166 of them. Oh, wow. Man, boy, I'm going to be popular when I die. Oh, well, no. And that's the gratification, though. One of my daughters, about a year ago, came in crying once because one of her friends started calling her names and everything. And we had a long talk about it, and I think I got it across to her because she steeled herself up and realized that those friends weren't friends, that they were just people on the internet somewhere. And if they thought that other people liked her better, they might retaliate by trying to make her feel worse. And that's a game that people play that I think we'll get into a little bit more later, but it's the gratification. I've got all these friends. It's the rejection when one of those friends turns against me. I don't even know the person. In her case, it's probably an avatar instead of a real person. She loves making avatars, by the way. So, it's a false reality. I don't know how else to describe it. And unfortunately, quite often, a lot of trust goes with that false reality. And well, I guess we could talk about CryptCheck right now. I wrote an article about Chief Mark Kessler. Actually, I wrote four articles about Mark Kessler, and the third one I talked about the entrapment of some patriots that were going to possibly attack a police station in Georgia and perhaps some other government buildings. They went on CryptCheck. Now, one of the guys called himself chief. Now, in my talking with Kessler, he says he's not the chief, but Kessler would not let anybody, he had to be called chief by these people in the Patriot community. So these people probably thought they were talking to Kessler, who they trusted implicitly because he was their friend. He said he was their friend. And it was part of the evidence used to set them up, and I guess their trial's coming up pretty soon. Trust a friend. You never know who's on the other side on the internet. And if you put your trust into that, you're also at the same time perhaps putting your neck on the chopping block.
Funny you should mention that. I remember when that article of yours came out, and I went and followed the one of the source links you gave, and it went straight to the ChatCrypt site, which I believe was chatcrypt.com. And I was reading on one of their pages because I've been doing some computer security research lately for some stuff I've been working on. But on one of the pages, it mentioned about how ChatCrypt uses AES 256 encryption. And then I thought back to what you wrote about Kessler, and the first thing I thought was, wow, even if ChatCrypt really was secure in a technological sense, it doesn't really matter if, if people are going to get in trouble because of, shall we say, user error, because the person on the other end of the line is intends some sort of malfeasance, shall we say.
Even without a picture, they're assuming, since they can't hear the voice, that they're talking to the person that they assumed that they were talking with.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
Well, let's go back to in Vortex. I referenced an article done by the University of Chicago back in the 90s, I think. Maybe it was in the 80s, but it was a study of the infiltration of the anti-war movement back in the 60s and early 70s. And the government actually set up SDS chapters on some campuses where they didn't exist so that they would have complete control and influence. Hey, you started SDS, you must be a good guy. And kind of like the internet friend, the persona that's presented is one of, hey man, I'm against the government, I'm against the war, I'm all this. And so they adhere themselves to him, but he's got a high degree of influence being the leader of the organization. So no, we don't want to do that. He can lead them. He can doesn't have complete control, but he has a great degree of influence. Just like the chairman of the board doesn't have complete control, but he's got a high degree of influence by controlling the agenda, by being able to allow speakers or not allow speakers or discourage speakers, things like that. A high degree of control. So what if the government now in this modern age, now that we've got the internet, sets up CryptChat or BurnNote or Hushmail? Is it possible that the government actually set these sites up so that we would think that we had security, we would drop our guard, we would talk about things we should never talk about on the internet, and the government's got a record? Now, some have suggested to me that if they did that, they would have come and busted me by now. No, they probably would have populated your file. But if people found out that they were reading the hush mail, reading the burn note, or reading everything in CryptChat. This goes back to World War II. We had the British had defeated Enigma. Learned how the Enigma code learned. They let a lot of people die because they didn't want to divulge the fact that they had learned how to decrypt Enigma. They were looking for the important stuff, and then they would try and develop by other sources support for that so that there was an appearance that it was discovered by other than reading the Enigma transmissions. Same thing with Japan. Japan, we had gotten most of their code figured out, decrypted, but we didn't want them to know that we decrypted it because it's important for them not to know that we know what they're doing. It's invaluable. So they're not going to come out and say, now this one, since the crypt chat was done by people that were government people, they can come out and say what happened because they can print it out because they're on one end of crypt chat and they can screenshot or grab the scroll. I don't know how it works, but just like anything else, you can grab the a Facebook PM, for example, you can grab the entire conversation and paste it in a document. And perhaps in CryptCheck you can, but if not, at least you can screenshot it. So they're not going to give up that they got it by being, say, the owners of CryptChat, but they've got a plausible story that they acquired it because they were participating in the conversation. So you don't know if CryptChat is secure or not. The same as they did with the Enigma and the Japanese codes. This is, how do you know?
Well, and then that kind of begs the question, doesn't it? I mean, does encryption make any difference at all? Or is using encryption at this point mere wishful thinking?
Well, I wrote an article a while back before Snowden came out, and Snowden was rather enlightening. They were so, well, the article was "Is Internet Safe for Patriot Communication?" And I would have no faith in any security on the internet. That will be qualified in a minute. But Snowden, when he was releasing information, realized that even though the government didn't have might not have a back door to PGP, that if he set up PGP communications with this one guy that he was leaking the information through, that if they got a hold of this guy's private key, they could spoof themselves into being this guy, and he would be sending them the information. So they went through a circuitous route on it. And on Greenwald's page, there's an article about this. But what they did is they passed the private key through a couple of people to get verification of the correct people on both sides being who they said they were. They used, anonymous email and set up this chain to create that verification so that he knew he didn't start releasing it to the government and go directly to jail, do not pass go, do not collect $200 type of scenario. So even Snowden was wary about the ability to, without a back door, to actually intrude within a PGP communication. And PGP is probably, by most, considered to be the most secure form of encryption on the internet because its longevity and Zimmerman's attitude from way back in the beginning. So, is there a way to communicate on the internet and expect some degree of security? Well, let's just say that we use PGP and the government had a back door, and I sent you a message, and the government, through the back door, decrypted that message, and they got garbage. Well, how could that possibly happen? I'm not smart enough, and I don't know if you could change the algorithm in PGP. But if I encrypted something by another method, and now there's encryption and coding, both, but encryption encrypted by another method on a computer not connected to the internet, and then I typed that in, or even copied it and pasted it in, and it's scrambled now, it's just a bunch of characters. Pasted that in, and then encrypted it in PGP, and sent it to you, and you had the means to take it then off of the computer, copy and paste onto a computer not on the internet, or do it manually by hand, decrypt it on pencil and paper. That the government, when they open this up, they'd see this garbage and say, "What the hell happened? Did they change the algorithm? What did they do? Maybe they encrypted it elsewhere. Well, what kind of code did they do that?" Well, we don't have the kind of brains in government that they had back in World War II that decrypted Enigma and decrypted the Japanese code. These guys know how to punch buttons on computers, so they'll be testing every code that they can possibly pull out of their resources to see if they can unscramble this. But if you've got one that's not unscramblable, then you might have secure communication via the internet. So
Sure, and and kind of like what you were touching upon there, the a lot of the government, more NSA type stuff, is very high tech. So if you were to try and get around that, it would make sense to go low tech, or at least combine, I think is what you were more getting at, is combining a low tech form of encryption, let's say, with a high tech one like PGP, almost like a dual layer of sorts, as it were. But yeah, I remember that article you wrote a while back. Oh, that's right. It was called "How Dangerous Is Internet Communication to Patriots?"
that's it.
And that was back in 2011. So yeah, that was definitely pre-Snowden. And and as time has gone on since then, a couple of years now, it's really just shown that there were some of us that understood that there were certain things that were happening. And that when Snowden came along, it was more just kind of like a confirmation and kind of throwing onto the pile of evidence, as it were, pretty much that the government has this surveillance dragnet via the internet and so forth, with all their databases and
Well,
malware and everything else.
I think last year I read something about they wanted to add 15,000 jobs to track and do things on the internet.
Well, didn't they also hold on? Wasn't there a couple articles too about the government hiring people to like not patrol, but like spread misinformation on like social media sites?
The ones that I've read had to not spread misinformation, but try and rebut or interrupt discussions. Their
You
focus
know.
was to distract from discussions. And, I've run into these a lot, and I've gotten, I think, pretty good at dealing with them because I don't let them get off the subject. But, there's some tactics. Somebody posted a comment. Was that on that article where the guy posted the comment that went into a little detail about some of the tactics? I think that guy Cav posted it. It was there, or Vortex, that he posted something that he found on the internet that talked about the tactics they use. But the idea is you first you try and take away go divert away from the subject. So you're talking about one thing, and they start talking about going finding a plausible place to go off to the side and draw you away from the subject, so that you don't persist in discussing the subject and perhaps defeating them in the discussion. They'll resort eventually to even attacking you. And so apparently they've got playbooks like telephone salespeople or tech support and things like that. So if this happens, do A, and if that doesn't work, do B, and if that doesn't work, do C. And if you're successful with C, then when he responds, go to the next page, do the A, B, or C. So they've got playbooks, and this guy had gotten a job at one of those and written an article about it, and I assume he's telling the truth because it's very feasible that he worked for months in a place like that, and he didn't like working there. He just his moral values did not allow him to continue working there, and so he came out and wrote a story about it. Is it true or not? I don't know. But is it plausible? Yes. That they do have these, I don't know what you call them, sweatshops, where the people's whole job is to go around to, they're probably assigned a certain page or a certain blog or a certain discussion group or a certain mail list, even, because I've run into them on a mail list that I was on a few years ago, and the tactics were there, and their purpose is to not let thoughts be carried to conclusion in the part of the other participants in the discussion, to detract from
Well,
them.
why do you think the rumor mill is so prevalent on the social networking websites?
Well, because people like sensationalism. I just wrote an article on the Illuminati and Tom Lacovara, where he took what he thought, or he claimed a French Canadian said, was the interpretation of what President Delinde said. However, in speaking with somebody, or I've tracked down through my resources, somebody that spoke fluent French and knew the idioms in France. And what he construed to be the Illuminati was in fact a verb talking about brightness or light, and it's sometimes used light in the head, crazy person, where the noun Illuminati would have been a different word altogether, and she provided that word. So, but people like hearing Illuminati. Oh, the Illuminati, they're behind everything. Now, according to Robeson, when he wrote the book Proof of Conspiracy back in 1798, he said the Illuminati, because of the French Revolution, had nearly ceased to exist. And nobody's shown me anything except speculation that the Illuminati's here 200 years later. But it's nice, and it could be that somebody read the title of the book or even read part of it, because it's a long book, and it talks about how Some people in Germany took what was happening in England with the Masons and converted that to a power structure where they had absolute influence and absolute obedience by the lesser people on it. And that became the Illuminati, and it was behind the French Revolution, and it was so much of a power struggle at the top that the leaders were trying to get control and cut off their competition's heads. And so obviously it was a failed system when people start losing their heads by obtaining higher levels. But there's a tendency to, well, we live in a world where somebody else is at fault for anything. So if somebody dies nowadays, it's somebody else's fault. Unless it's the government's fault, then it's the fault of the individual that he died. The only time it's the fault of the individual when the government is the one that caused the death. Anything else, plane crash, thousands of people die. 300 million people in this country, average life expectancy, say 72 years. How many thousands of people die every day in this country? Thousands. So they can't all have suspicious circumstances. The list that was made, I'm not sure if Linda Thompson made the list, but she sure spread it around back in the 90s. If somebody got close to Clinton, she called them a bodyguard, when in fact they were on a different helicopter. They were part of a Marine group, and two, I think it was two of them, died in a helicopter crash. And so she claimed the bodyguards were killed by the government because they were close to Clinton and knew things. And we like those. When I say we, I say collectively as the majority of the patriot community, we like those things because it makes the government evil. Well, hell, I don't need that to know how evil the government is. But there's a tendency to like that because that proves what I've been saying. That proves, how many proofs of what I've been saying do I need? Damn, people. You don't need
Right,
all
and
this conspiracy theory. If you can't prove it, don't say it. There's enough honest stuff out there to show how evil the government is.
it's and like the government is something that is pretty much easily identifiable, right? I mean, there are approximately 535 tyrants we can identify by face and name, and that's just the legislative branch alone. I don't really see the necessity that some other folks feel a necessity for. To basically finger point at what seem to be these convenient boogeymen, whether it be the Illuminati, the Freemasons, the Jesuits, or whomever it happens to be, the villain this week. It seems to be kind of a rotating basis, almost like a series of like those Russian dolls, except that in this case, it's almost like the Russian dolls are all the same size, and you could just rearrange the order of the dolls depending on what you read on the internet last night. It's about that bad.
It is, and what effect does it have in the patriot community too? One of my signatures, you've seen it, is so long as we fight amongst ourselves, we will never have to face the more dangerous task of fighting against our enemy. So, if somebody's level-headed and wants proof of something as opposed to speculation, all of a sudden, we've got controversy between these two people, and this person, person A, has people on his side that believe like A, and B has people on his side that believe like B, and so we've got a conflict amongst ourselves. And the thing is the government responsible for this or not responsible for this? So we're not fighting the government, we're fighting each other, and the government knows this, so they plant seeds. They like to propagate things into the community, back to the sweatshop, the rooms where these guys go. They'll try and propagate things like that. They'll take the patriot mythology, certain of the items, it might be a French flag or something, but they'll throw that in there to see if they can create so much disruption that we forgot what the original conversation was in the first place.
Yeah, going off on tangents and all that.
Right.
Well, why do you think people are so prone to accept the so-called information being run through by this rumor mill?
Well, when I was a kid, if I did something, I was responsible for my actions. I was punished by my parents. I might be punished by the school by suspension or expulsion. I might be punished by the police if it was bad enough. We took responsibility for our actions, but nobody does that nowadays. Again, somebody else is always responsible if something goes wrong. I don't let my daughters get away with that because they'll try and blame something else, there's a tendency in our society, and I think it came from the government because they're never responsible for anything that goes wrong. They enact a law and it fails, and they unenact the law or revise the law and it still fails, but they're not responsible because they're looking for a solution. And usually it requires great amounts of dollars to find that solution. So over a period of time, we've been, and I don't know what they're teaching in the public schools. They might even have a class on somebody else's responsible 101. But we have become a society where I'm never responsible for my actions. It's always somebody else's fault. It's been ingrained in people, and I see it in a lot of the patriots. They're never responsible. Somebody else is always responsible for what goes wrong.
Yeah, it's a victim mentality.
Victim mentality, yeah. Okay, so when you've got that mentality, it's easy to try and find the boogeyman. And the boogeyman's always the government in what we're talking about right now. It's always the government. Somebody dies, it's the government's fault. Well, that's the boogeyman. They did it, All these people died because they knew Bill Clinton, or they knew this, or they knew that. SEAL Team 6, what do they call that? I forgot what they call it, but when the helicopter crashed. And they said,
Black Hawk Down, you mean? Or
No, the more recent one.
Yeah, I'm not quite as familiar with that.
I don't remember what it's called, but basically they're saying, well, that was a setup. They crashed that helicopter to kill these guys. I wonder if the pilot was a part of that conspiracy. And he, I don't know what it was, but we know that they have surface-to-air handheld missiles, and helicopters are very susceptible to that. They don't lay out chaff. They don't have the protections that the big jets and bombers have, and so all it takes is a surface, handheld surface to air, and you can blow up a helicopter. These guys are in a combat zone. Oh, they were all in the same helicopter. Well, they're a team, yes, so they usually go out in the same helicopter too.
Mm-hmm.
But wait, no, it's got to be a conspiracy. So, this is a fuel of disruption. And so if the government sees a story like this come out, then they'll do everything they can to keep that flame burning and growing. They'll throw tinder on the file. Good example, too, and this had to do with the Bundy Ranch, and it was called the drone strike, that the Oath Keepers, who had gone to protect the property and the Bundy family, Bundy property and Bundy family, were encamped there, but they couldn't take control of this whole thing. Now, I can't say that Oath Keepers was behind this, but what happened is somebody that does, from time to time, and fairly frequently, Mr. X, who I've spoken with, is in communication with people who work for government, and they're doing online searches for things, trying to track things down. He only works with out of country, but one of the people he trusts that he works with on that network is retired military or active military, I don't recall which right now. But the guy called him and said, this is what's going to happen. And the seed was there was going to, Holder had ordered a drone strike on the Bundy Ranch. The drones to observe and had given approval for a Bundy, for a missile strike. And by the description, it would have to be a hellfire to have the effect that was being sought. Now, it said that Holder had directed DOD. Now, I didn't know that the Attorney General of the United States could tell the Defense Department what to do. Problem number one. Would the government fire a hellfire missile in this country, killing hundreds of people, including women and children? That would be bad press. There you would have a true conspiracy, irrefutably, because nobody else happens to have hellfires in this country. The government must have done it. But it became a scapegoat for the Oath Keepers to back out of the Bundy Ranch and abandon their mission to protect the Bundys. They didn't try and get the Bundys out. They wanted to get themselves out, so they went to the motel, started drinking, gambling, and things like that.
Yeah, and anyone who criticized them, it was all sorts of invective. I remember that at the time. And, I've noticed this not just with the so-called Oath Keepers, but I've also noticed this with other people as well, that they like to pull these guilt trips with people that kind of point out their inconsistencies or faults or errors or whatever else. And you know, my personal favorite guilt trip excuse is, if you don't agree with me, then you don't care about the truth.
Yes, and see, we're getting off subject. We've got to get back on friends. But yes, if a friend tells me that, I don't want to lose that friendship. I like the fact that I've got 7,432 friends, and I don't want to go down to 7,431 friends. So then I've got to appease that person.
Toe the party line, as it were. Well, what do you think are the incentives for people to disseminate the, you know, this so-called information?
Well, first, endearment, the friendship. I mean, that's the element behind all this because, you know, if somebody else says it doesn't really matter, but when a friend says it, then I'm challenging, I'm testing whether I've got the respect of that friend. So I can use that desire for recognition, for respect, and use that as a tool against the people. Not that wasn't true in the drone strike thing necessarily. However, we were talking about influence in the community. Now, when it comes down to friends, how often do you see friends tell friends that, "Hey, Gary Hunt's John Doe 4"? Oh, he must be John Doe 4 because a friend told me that. Right?
Yeah, it's almost as if they'd never heard the, or were knowledgeable about the concepts of misinformation or even disinformation.
Right. And that's explained in the article Vortex, how that's used, how the government since 1972 at least has gone after the outspoken people in any community to undermine them, to get them arrested and thrown in jail. And friends are a good source on that. So Facebook is really a platform that makes it a little easier because of that endearment that comes with the calling them friends to let's say give an unearned credibility to accusations like that.
Well, what are the consequences of the proliferation of this information on the internet, though?
Disruption? Why, what did I just read you? We were so busy fighting ourselves that we avoid the more difficult task of fighting the government. There's division, divide and conquer. One of the first articles I put after I put my blog out, it might have been the first one, divide and conquer. If we can do anything to keep these people apart and not let them realize that there is one solution, and that's restoring constitutional government, if we can keep them away from that concept, we got it made. They'll be so busy fighting amongst themselves or pursuing frivolous ends that they, in most of them, so you expose something. 9/11 truce, good example. So you approve the government's behind this. Okay, when you've proven that, what's changed? Oh, well, then people will really be upset with the government. Well, wait a minute. I've been upset with the government for 22 years now since they burned those women and children in Waco. I don't need 9/11 truth to be upset with the government, pissed off at the government. But it's more fun to play the game.
Yes.
Rightful indignation. How's that?
Sure, almost for its own sake, I think is kind of what you were getting at. Well, you mentioned Facebook earlier. What role do you think does Facebook, as I guess the world's largest forum board, play in disseminating this information?
Well, you know, they've got the class act. They've got the friends. They've got the endearment built into it. It's not contacts, it's friends. And you've got to respect your friends, otherwise they will unfriend you.
That almost sounds like a psyop type thing, almost.
Facebook created a forum that created an endearment, a false endearment. That comes from the association. I think that all of us in our youth knew that the friends were the ones we played with at school, played with after school, played with on weekends, spent time with. We knew what friends were. And there's a subtle transition now into the internet. So instead of going outside to get the friends when see my friends when it's raining, I can go online and see my friends and I don't get wet. So this subtle transition, now it carries the emotional attachment, at least to some degree, if not a high degree. of that affection between the parties.
Well, what you just described is essentially the association fallacy. You know, just because you know, the qualities of one thing are similar to another does not necessarily mean that they are inherent in the other or even correct.
Well, is it a fallacy in the mind of the player?
Good point. Well, is there a false sense of security, though, when people are conversing with each other on the internet?
Oh, absolutely. Crypt chat, crypt chat, crypt chat. Hey, we can go there. Unseen, IS. The interesting thing about unseen is their server may be what they say it is. And it is possible that there is encryption before it's transmitted to Iceland and goes on the page there. However, to get to Iceland, it travels some electronic highways. Unless it's changed, there were seven principal nodes in this country, the original infrastructure for the internet. So when it goes from your computer out, it goes through at least one of those nodes. So that information being transmitted to Iceland, encrypted, if the government has the means to decrypt that, grabs it at that node. I got to tell a kind of humorous story. Years ago, when I was county surveyor in Seminole County, Florida, a guy had some paperwork he had to send to his insurance company, and he was a field guy, and so he asked me to make sure that it got faxed to the insurance company that day. And so I took it up to the engineer's office and faxed it to the insurance company and brought it back down, put a note, and said, "We faxed it today." He got back. He didn't even read the note. He said, "I asked you to send this to the insurance company. And it's here, right here. You didn't send it." Wait a minute. No, this is the electronic age. I sent it via a fax, and this is your copy back. You know, the fax machine doesn't eat yours up, spit it out on the other end. It's not a transporter, but he had trouble with that concept. But the thing is, now a fax transmission could be intercepted because it's sending O's and I's through, a signal through. And if I have the resource to pull that signal off and read it and let it continue on at the same time, then I see what's in that fax by just stripping off, and there's no degeneration. I just strip it off. I've got a copy too. You send an email to 500 people in one push of the button. It doesn't degenerate the email that goes to Joe when Sam gets one. And by the same token, anything transmitted through that electronic highway can be stripped off without denigrating the original product. So what goes to Iceland can be captured by the government. Whether they can do anything with it or not, I don't know. But I'm going to assume that they can. So I'll never talk about anything unless I use that two-step method I mentioned earlier to communicate with friends, even. If I know the friends and trust them, to get back to that point.
Well, I just what do you think motivates people to participate in these activities we've just discussed?
Well, it broadens at this point to discuss that, but you know, I remember back, oh shit, it got to be 35, maybe 35, 40 years ago. We got Nintendo, or Coleco was the first one because we called it Coleco Thumb. We got it for Christmas for my children, and we spent the whole Christmas night using our thumb and fingers to play these games. They were kind of obscure in today's games, but played them, and our thumbs were sore from pushing the buttons. Now I'm sure that people have gotten out of that. They exercise their thumbs frequently nowadays, but back then you didn't, so your thumbs were sore, so we called it Coleco Thumb. But you had Nintendo and all these other things, and they're games where you get to go in and play around. There was one, well, there were a number of them, no sense going into any. Basically, what I'm doing is I'm going in and I'm a hero when I do these things and those things and that, all this stuff. And if I get killed, though, well, it's okay. I can come back to life, or I can start over. So we got in the habit back then of saving the game if we were going to go into some dangerous area, so we didn't have to retrace our building our strength up and everything. And if I start to get damaged, I can always go find a heart, and all of a sudden my broken limbs come back to full power. That was the beginning of the role-playing games. Now, they've gotten very sophisticated with these, and I can't tell you how sophisticated because I don't think I've played one for 20 or 30 years. But I see people getting engrossed in this. They're living a life. They're talking on Skype at the same time or a chat that's associated with the role-playing games. And they killed a monster. Yay, we did it together. There's even teamwork in these things now, where it used to be individuals. Now it's teamwork, and we killed that monster. It's role-playing. It's safe. We can take on the government on the computer. Well, somebody's just got to write the game where there's the government, the FBI, the DHS, and all these agencies, and here's a bunch of patriots, and we'll go on and kick their ass, and we'll take over the government, and we'll hang all the congressmen, and you can do it online. Very good, because if I get killed in the process, I just wait 5 minutes and I can come back to life.
Oh, wow.
Well,
That's
that's role playing. Now, let's broaden that a little bit. We're so caught up. I mean, I keep getting these invites to the games on the internet, and there's some really sophisticated Warcraft, all these other ones are very pretty sophisticated. I don't play them. But these people get caught up in these role-playing games. Now, since they're doing it on the computer, if I play football and baseball outside, that's two different games. I play them both outside. I play role-playing games on the computer and I shift over to Facebook. Am I taking my role-playing mentality to Facebook or to a discussion group or to a mail list at the same time? Am I playing role-playing when I'm dealing with other people on the internet, just like I do with these fictitious characters in a role-playing game? There's a phrase that we've all heard: keyboard commandos, keyboard warriors,
Armchair generals.
armchair generals, and there's probably a few others. That's alluding to the fact that it's a role-playing game. But the difference between a role-playing game and this is, the role-playing game, there's one set of circumstances in the game, but out here in the real virtual world that's not real, there are thousands of places I can play. So it becomes even more intriguing, doesn't it?
That's almost like saying that much of the alternative media now is really nothing more than, or at least much of it,
Role-playing? Oh, wow.
yeah,
Did
like an MMO.
I
Yeah,
say
like,
that? Oh, shame on me.
yeah, like it, as if it were like an MMORPG, like World of Warcraft or something along those lines. Oh, wow, that would actually.
Playing it in real life, because I'm
Oh,
used
dude.
to playing it, and I use the same bat for football and baseball. I use the same pointy ball for football and baseball. It's transitional. I use the same keyboard to defeat monsters, to defeat the government, to defeat those people I don't like in Facebook.
My God, that really would explain a lot of the infighting we've seen over the years, wouldn't it? Or at least a portion of it.
It would. The mentality, the seeds coming from sources that want to see the division, the role playing is easy to do. I make a point. I had a discussion with a guy recently over an article I wrote about Chris Blystone, and he was prying to me, "What's your deepest source?" And he kept prying and prying, email correspondence back and forth. He's prying, "Who's your deepest source?" So I wrote to him this morning, and I said, "I might be willing to give up my deepest source because you said you had some information. Now, if you can tell me what that information is, and then I give up my deepest source, but I have to have assurance that you will provide me the information to back up, to the evidence to give credibility, to verify the information you give me." So it was one, two, three. You tell me what you're offering. I'll give you the name, but you have to assure me that you will give me then the proof of the allegations. And so he wrote back and said, "Oh, I'm no longer interested in your deepest source." He spent days trying to get it out of me. Is
Interesting
that role
turn of
playing?
tale.
It is.
Oh.
Fascinating. So I went in, I didn't go in naively, believe me. My intention with what I said is I got permission from the source to divulge the name, and I acted like I didn't have permission. I think I suggested that I might be violating a trust. Might be. I know I wasn't. But I wanted him to think that that he was getting something for it, but all of a sudden he didn't want to play anymore. So he was role playing, but it appears that he couldn't slay the monster. And so he decided he was going to go find another monster to slay. So I don't know if I'll hear from him again.
Well, is there any way we can tell the difference between role playing and sincerity?
And the internet? Perhaps longevity, frequency. What I was, let me go through that last setup. I don't know what this guy has to offer. He's just, about six or seven iterations back and forth on the discussion. He's trying to get information, saying he has information. He never, I know what he's trying to get, the deepest source. He used that phrase, deepest source. When I told him a lot of people worked on the investigation, I want your deepest source. And he put it in quotes. He kept saying he had information that would prove this, or he didn't even say what it would prove, but you'll really like this stuff. So he was teasing me, trying to entice me. And, I was on top of it. I'm kind of astute. I know what's happening. And so I just played along. And, some of the people I work with, I shared that with them for the laughs more than anything, because it was very apparent what the guy was trying to do. But how do you tell if somebody's sincere? One way is to test them. And if he would give me some information on that first step of the three step that I mentioned, if he provided said I will be able to prove this, 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 and this, if it was interesting, I might have stepped in and said, okay, I'll go along with it. Here's the name. Now, if he gave me the evidence, then I would have a little faith in him. He still might be working for the government. It depends on the depth of the information and the difficulty in acquiring the evidence. But I would still keep at a distance from that guy for a long time and work with him quite a bit before I would ever give up anything that I felt came under that cloak of my integrity and my loyalty to my sources to not divulge them. So how do you build it up? You only build it up over time, but you've got to have tests in there that are sufficient to determine if what you're getting is real. And it's not easy on the internet. It's almost impossible. People talk about meetups. Are they any good? Interestingly, found out recently that the FBI has been called following Casey Massey since Laredo. Not since Camp Lone Star, but across the state in Laredo. He has no idea who the person was that was reporting to the government, probably BATF, at Laredo. But
Oh, wow.
there's intrusion in the Patriot community, there's befriending and all this. People that Massey thought were good people weren't necessarily good people after all. And somewhere in there is that element that you'd never know. Well, let's go to Hutterite Militia. The best man at the leader of the Hutterite Militia's friend, the best man at his wedding, was the government informant. Let's look at the guy in Alaska. What's his name?
Norm Olson, you mean?
No, the other one, the one that got busted for
Oh,
fraud.
Schaefer
Schaefer
Cox.
Cox. He had a circle. I think it was 12 people in the circle. And one of these people that he'd met and spent time with was the informant. Let's think about something real quick, too. I was talking about the virtual games, and if you get killed, give it 5 minutes. Maybe, I guess some of them you might even have to trade some stuff to get your life back and you're back alive. When we're role playing in the Patriot community, for example, though, it's a little bit different. If you get killed on one discussion board, you're not going to be able to come back to life if you really got trashed. So there's always another discussion board. So the only difference is instead of getting my life back over here, I just go over here to this game, this other discussion board, or a different group on Facebook, or something like that. But role playing has become such a way of life for most people on the internet that I'm not so sure that they can really consciously distinguish between the two unless it's brought to their attention and they recognize it and then they decide to address it.
Wow, that's a really rather stark way of putting it. Well, wouldn't it be safer from a privacy, or shall I say, perhaps a counter-surveillance standpoint, for patriots to talk to each other in person rather than to do so, say, in a chat room?
I would think that anybody that was going to have any serious communications that might have ramifications based on the proliferation of laws against doing just about anything in this country, even putting in a full-flush toilet instead of a water-saving toilet or, incandescent light bulbs, that first, back to what we talked about, meeting somebody, becoming a friend of that person, knowing him well enough, meeting him enough times where there's a comfort level. That won't always do it. But without that initial sixth sense judgment that I like this guy, back to Hootery Militia, best man at the wedding, informant. But at least absent that foundation, I wouldn't go anywhere else. Now, maybe long term. Years in my relationship, me with other people on the internet, some of them that I've been friends with on the internet, and approaching real friends for more than 10 years, that maybe 15 years, that I would trust with things. At that point, I might consider internet communications, but how would I set that up? Well, I'm talking with the guy right now about doing a story on his case, but at this point he doesn't want anything divulged, but I want to get a head start on the story. So he sent me some information, and what we do is, even in priority mail, the cardboard mailers, he will put a sheet of tinfoil in that to make sure that they can't read through that. Years ago I saw them take a regular mail, 7 pages, electronically shoot it. I don't remember what it was, X-ray or some method, but they could actually, because the characters are connected, they could unfold all 7 pages, separate them, and read the message. So even the mail is not safe unless you do something to block that, and then you can put tape on or not, but you sign your name over the seal on it so that you know that it's been broken if it's gone through. But to establish how you're going to communicate online, you have to first set that process, that procedure, the keys, the methodology, and everything up offline. So you meet the guy, you have faith in him. Then you set up via mail. If you're far apart, if you're not too far apart, you go meet each other and exchange the information, have a beer, and things like that. But then you can might be able to go into internet communication, going back to that double layered thing where you encrypt off, then encrypt on, then send, and he takes off and then encrypts off. I don't know how else to do it, but now there's another consideration too, and I consider this, that if I've got 5 people around the country that I have set up communications with, there are variations in those. So if it's compromised on one, it's not compromised to the other 4. Can you be
Huh.
overly cautious? Oh no, you cannot be too cautious.
Wow. Okay. Well, I guess with everything that you and I have discussed tonight, do you think there is any solution to this problem?
Caution. There is no solution as long as we continue the practices, we accept the verbicide of the word friend, and have reliance that this guy talks big, so he must be real. Let's go back to Chris Blystone. I talked to a number of people in the process of doing the story on Chris Blystone, and everybody said he's a smooth talker. He creates that endearment. I think that I've seen some indications in writing, and he is smooth. He's approached a subject different ways. If one doesn't work, he goes to another. So he's pretty sharp. For a guy that inspected food for before he got booted out of the army, he's pretty sharp. That's the kind that make hustlers. people that hustle other people for money, especially back in the 30s. So he's
Ugh.
got the characteristics to endear people to him. So it's easy to make the friends, even in person. But how do you know how real they are? So what is the solution? Build your trust slowly. Do it as I've suggested, offline. Meet the person. If you can't meet him, establish something for years. Maybe even throw some tests out there to see if there's a reaction. But it's your neck that's going to go on the chopping block if you fail to use the amount of caution necessary to avoid that. It's perhaps not impossible to completely avoid it. You might get trapped somewhere along the line. Now, this works on the assumption that you're doing something or talking about something that would be considered illegal. There was on the news just a little while ago, these two boys made a YouTube video, and it was how to kill your teacher. And it was just, I was looking at it, and shit, we used to do that when we played cops and robbers when I was a kid. Well, now it's illegal. They're going to bust these kids for this. Mm-hmm. So the intrusion of these laws on how we live our lives and this mentality of somebody else is at fault, and all these things come together to create a different society than what I was used to. So things might be illegal that were not illegal then, like playing cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians, war, different games we played. We even shot each other with bows and arrows with wood blunt points on them, I add, but and not full draw on it. But we threw rocks. We had rock fights, BB gun fights. Nobody ever lost an eye. But the world has changed. If you had a BB gun fight now, you'd probably both get arrested. So the world has changed, and so it doesn't have to be what should be considered criminal, which is an injured party or destruction, injured property. Now it's just thought crimes can get you arrested. Play acting can get you arrested, like these two boys that got arrested out here in California. They weren't in California. I'm sorry, I forgot where it was. But they did a YouTube video, and it was real poor quality, blurry. But they were playing how to kill your teacher with toy guns, and it looked just like we did when we were kids. That has become illegal. So that means that there's even additional security required in what should not be considered criminal activity or criminal conversation on the internet. Your thoughts, your words can get you arrested. That used to not be true. That came under freedom of speech.
Sure. And, you were kind of mentioning, I guess, what would some people would consider to be vetting. And, something I've noticed is that if whomever you're associating with or trying to learn about anyway, if they can't accept constructive criticism, criticism that's given in good faith, because they are interpreting it as a challenge to their good name, their reputation, for me, that's kind of a red flag I've seen over and over again.
Well, it could be, but it can also be symptomatic of what we talked about. If I did something wrong, it's not my fault, and it's your fault for bringing it to my attention. So it's hard to say what might cause that. Always look at all the possibilities, and one of the possibilities is that it's your fault because you drew that out of me. Isn't it? Possible.
yeah, I guess it is possible. Well, I think it was something too that that a fellow mentioned. I don't remember his name right offhand, but he termed it conspiratainment, which of course is a neologism for conspiracy entertainment. And he was describing it as a I think I wrote an article on this once, but the idea being is that where people kind of go through this rumor mill and they promote whatever the boogeyman is of the week. Because it is a form of entertainment. And so I think what you've mentioned tonight about role-playing being pretty much a form of entertainment, I think kind of answers a lot of questions I had anyway.
Well, let's look at another interpretation of conspiratainment. Conspiracy containment. That's what we need to practice. Containing the conspiracies.
Sure.
When you said that, that's what he meant. Entertainment, not containment. I prefer containment. Yes, we've got to exert ourselves in an honest and objective evaluation of what's happening, and look if we are not if we are responsible for our actions, then we should adjust our actions to remove this destructive practice that's prolific on the internet.
Sure. And, you know, one other neologism I just thought of that I think is relevant here is one that's been coined relatively recently, which is in more libertarian circles, but it's the celebritarian, which, of course, is a portmanteau for a celebrity libertarian, somebody who kind of, you know, gets on the internet and makes a name for themselves, you know, basically being an agitator of sorts. And I think something that can't,
is
that
that
should
a
at least.
VBF? Very best friend that they're trying to achieve with them?
Something like that, yeah, sure. Someone with name recognition, right?
Right.
As some marketing professionals would say. And something I've noticed is that maybe, or I've observed is that perhaps if many of us were a little bit more critical in good faith, you know, against folks who made all sorts of claims up and down the line, whether it's you know, fringe flags or whatever else. To really say, well, is what he said really true, accurate information, or is it misinformation, or maybe it's even disinformation, and just be a lot more skeptical overall.
Well, let's look at dealing with it. You brought something up, constructive criticism. Constructive criticism, one, should be accepted, but two, it should be presented properly too, because if you constructively criticize somebody in public, it's not going to be received. You have created a wall of belligerence. You've got them pissed off at you, and they're going to, no, if they realize they're wrong, they'll defend that they were right because you've created their wall of belligerence. And so there has to be tact in helping somebody. You know, I can be pretty blunt. You know that. You've been around me. You know, if you screw up, I'll tell you you screwed up. But
sure,
you know me well enough to take it in good faith, and we'll laugh about it. But most people can't do that because they take it too seriously. Oh,
yeah.
You're being critical of me rather than trying to help me improve myself. So
right.
If you are going to use constructive criticism with somebody, it's very important to, one, not do it in public, and two, do it in such a manner, the best you can, to not make it a criticism, rather a productive conversation.
Right, and I think if people were to take that to heart a lot more, you know, a lot more often, I don't think we'd see. I honestly don't think we'd see so much discord with people arguing. You know, when is something a fact, when it's not a fact, or confusing fact with opinion, or whatever else is coming out of the rumor mill when they're trying to discuss it with their so-called friends, as it were.
Well, that takes it back to the we didn't mention the Latin phrase, but ad hominem arguments that we talked about earlier, when you attack somebody because you can't undermine their argument. And that is intended as a criticism. They imply that it's constructive, but in fact it's destructive because the intention is to destroy you. And so we see that, and we might tend to emulate it because we see it so often. But that constructive criticism has to be productive, and it has to be in private.
One of the I just thought of something you just kind of spurred a thought in me. You know, there are various like threads on Facebook, I think you and a few other folks have shown me over the years. And whenever I've looked at them, something I've noticed constantly, besides, of course, what you and I have discussed already, is that there are so many logical fallacies made that I think I've mentioned, at least in private, that, oh, you know, so-and-so just made, you know, like an argument from silence or an argument from ignorance, which, of course, are fallacies regarding whatever the subject is. So that's something I've kind of seen with these internet friends and their rumor mills, is that much, even the way in which they're trying to describe whatever the details are concerning a particular topic is very much irrational.
Well,
it's actually quite shocking for me.
Right, and I think, you know, it was 45, 50 years ago when I studied it, but there are 7 or 9 arguments that are false arguments. Ad hominem is the one that we see quite often and is mm-hmm. easily identified because I call you names, quite simply. There's omission. I'm using the English now. There's omission can be an argument too, that you leave out one of the elements that was presented and argue against the remaining elements. So by omitting that one argument, you can come up with a logical argument attacking the other 90% of what was said. But when I throw that piece back into place, it destroys the argument. So that is one of omission that I see fairly often. Yes, it would be good if people would. I'm sure you can find, do a Google search for logical arguments and find those seven or nine, whatever it is, and look at them and understand how to understand when the argument that they're arguing is one that is used to deceive and detract from the discussion at hand.
Right, and I think the more that the lot we all stay on topic with whatever we're talking about and do not go off on tangents, I think that too, and I think would also be a another possible solution to the problem.
Well, I think that's one of the arguments. I would call it an argument of detraction or distortion or redirection. But yes, that is, I think, one of the arguments where you get off the subject. Like I say, it's been a long time. But where you change the subject or broaden it enough that it loses its flavor. I still remember one from a long time ago. I lived in Pittsburgh at the time, and I was having a conversation with a guy, and we were talking about water. And he said, "Well, when I say water, I mean potable water." Oh, shit, we've just excluded 90%, 95% of the water in the world. It's in the ocean. He wanted to redefine something to the exclusion or the omission of the majority of the water in the world. He didn't want to say potable water. He wanted to say water, and water was something that you could drink. So I couldn't talk about the ocean anymore. I couldn't say seawater because water's been defined as potable. And see, that's an example of a sort of an omission. Understanding those things, understanding the use of words, for example, friends. What is a friend? Or are they really friendlies? Because they are friendly towards you, but they aren't necessarily friends. So friendlies, not friends. Contacts, not friends. Understand what's happening, what you're seeing. Learn to recognize it, and it's valuable. I've spent a lot of time with some of my friends that, I'm sorry, my friendlies, talking with them because I see them getting in pissing contests on Facebook discussions or other discussions. And this is where you start slinging shit one at a time and hoping something sticks. They think that that's effective because they're putting out truth, but unless I have all the truths together at one time, I don't know which water I'm talking about. But it's understanding what's happening. So I've gotten a number of them to stop getting in pissing contests because I try and explain when they throw that out there. I've had them pull posts because I want them to understand how this works so they can have a grasp on the available reality on the internet rather than being deceived by the majority of information, which is disreality. So don't rely on your friends or your friendlies. Rely on your true friends, the people that you've established your relationship, but always be cautious of them too, because they don't need to know something that doesn't involve them. And that's probably the best protection. If I'm talking Joe about one thing and Sam about another, why should I tell Sam what I'm talking to Joe about? So if I get that compartmentalization, the need to know, just remember the concept, need to know. Does Sam need to know what Joe and I are talking about? No, because if Sam is bad, even though I had implicit trust in Sam, if he is bad, I've just screwed Joe. It needs to stop at me if I did something wrong. I can't bring Joe into if Sam's bad.
Well, you've certainly given me quite a bit to think about, and I thank you for that. It's just, I don't know, considering a lot of what you've mentioned tonight, I think for me personally, I would just rather emphasize working on local at this point, with people I can, see and, shake their hand and so forth. So,
Well, does that
well,
mean we're not going to be able to work together anymore?
No,
Oh, okay, good.
but I said emphasizing it though. But it's an issue with emphasis.
It is. It is. And but like I say, our trust has been built over a long time, and there are many things that I won't tell you that are going on, and you know that. And sometimes it's crossed in the mix that somebody else has told Sam what Joe and they were talking about, and they've been explained that constructive criticism that we can't do that, and there are various reasons for that. But the point is that those lines shouldn't be crossed. And I trust you not to cross them, and I trust the other people not to cross them now because we've discussed it with constructive criticism, polite and cordial. Sometimes it gets a little heavy because people might be offended because of it, but the fences have all been mended, and that's the important thing.
Sure. Well, thank you for talking to me about this because it's something that's been weighed on my mind, and how you explained role playing too really answered quite a bit of what I was concerned about. So, thank you, Gary. I appreciate it.